Welcome to the Thriving Birth Worker Podcast, a space for conversations about how you, the birth worker, can create not only a fulfilling and sustainable career, but a joyful and thriving life. I'm Erin Underwood, an educator, movement specialist, mother of four boys, and a total anatomy nerd. My passion is to see birth workers encouraged, supported, and empowered in their careers and life. In today's episode, I get to have a conversation with psychologist Dr. Erin Bao. I found my new Australian friend through her podcast, Birth Trauma Training for Birth Workers. Her heart to support the birth working community is what drew me to her and her work. Her story is powerful, and the way she approaches, sees, and legitimizes birth trauma, specifically for birth workers, is a perspective I haven't heard very often. Dr. Erin Bao is a clinical and perinatal psychologist and a coach in Victoria supporting birth workers through birthwork. After watching her own doula struggle to process the unfolding of her second traumatic birth, it occurred to her, where was the support and where is the trauma-informed practice? She has over 10 years experience working in private practice, assisting women and families in perinatal support before and during pregnancy, and even postpartum with parent coaching and child adolescence mental health. And here is our conversation. Hello, and welcome to today's podcast. Today, I have Dr. Erin Bao with me, and she is a clinical and perinatal psychologist who focuses a lot of her attention on birth workers and helping them process through just the psychological and the emotional side of the work. And I'm so excited to have you here today, Erin. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for asking me. This is lovely being a guest instead of the host. It's kind of strange.
Fabulous. So you are from?
Well, I'm from a tiny island down the bottom of Australia called Tasmania originally, and now I am living in the Macedon Ranges in Victoria. Still in Australia.
Fabulous. I love your accent.
I don't have an accent. So, you have an accent.
I know. That's so true. My American accent. I like it. So the two Erins are coming at you today. So Erin, for those of my listeners who haven't heard of you, could you just give us a little bit of background of what you do and how you got there?
So many moons ago, it feels like, I trained as a clinical psychologist, and part of that work was always doing perinatal work, always loved parents and babies and that whole unit of people. And then eventually I had my two own little babies who made very dramatic entrances into the world. So I'm that kind of person that you hold up and go, well, yeah, okay, traumatic birth happens even if you do all the prep. So, you know, even though I'm white, educated, had an obstetrician, had a doula, did hypnobirthing, had all the birth plans, did all the things, I still had two traumatic births. And I, strangely enough, have used that to have a almost, not a total career change, but I would say that's the primary thing that I do now. Is birth trauma. And a huge part of that is supporting birth workers, because for me, definitely in my second birth, my doula was the person who she will probably keep saying that she doesn't think she did that much and didn't help that much. But really, that was the difference between a traumatic birth that could have been really, really, really difficult to deal with and process and kind of find a new normal in, versus like, oh, I actually kind of came out of that okay. But I guess what I thought was interesting in the weeks, and I still think about it now, so it's nearly 2 years since I had my youngest daughter, and in the weeks that passed after her birth, I kept thinking, oh, I'm okay, like, I seem okay, and my doula was not. She just, like, she's one of the strongest people I know, right, and that's why I hired her, but she just really struggled, and I began to sort of do some digging and go, do you know what? With vicarious trauma, for the people who are there watching, witnessing, hearing everything unfold, there's absolutely nothing. There's no support. You're just expected to pick yourself up, put yourself in your car, go back to your kids, go back to your partner, and act like what? everything is fine because it's not your birth. It's not about you. You're supposed to be strong. Rada, 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 rada. So yeah, that has propelled me into going, nope, this is not good enough, because that one person, I mean, there was a team of people, but it really was my doula who completely and utterly changed my life. I'm like, well, I can't keep sitting back and seeing this happen, because all the amazing birth workers will burn out and get compassion fatigue and they'll leave. And my two daughters, if they choose to have babies one day, will be ending up with this skeleton staff of jaded, burnt out, miserable, narcissistic people. And I don't want that. I want good people to stay. So we have to look after them.
That's amazing. I love your story. So I love the term, and I'm really interested if you could dive a little bit deeper. You use the term vicarious trauma. Mm. So I think sometimes we can often devalue an experience or feelings that we're having, or we can easily minimize something if it didn't directly happen to us. And so can you talk a little bit about your experience and your, you know, even just how you validate or how you treat or how you talk to someone about this experience or this idea of vicarious trauma?
I guess the thing with trauma in general to remember is there's three ways that you can develop it, and whether that means you have what's called little t trauma. So as in, it's not a full-blown post-traumatic stress disorder response, but it's some, whoa, what just happened and I'm struggling to cope. But generally after a month or so, things are not too bad. Or through to full-blown PTSD, you can get that by something directly happening to you. You can get it by witnessing it happening to someone else, and you can get it by hearing a horrible story. It happens to first responders, emergency service workers, police officers, paramedics, therapists, childbirth education teachers, like a whole range of people who hear and witness and see traumatic births happening or any sort of trauma happening before you would even go and see someone like me, like a clinical psychologist or a coach or someone like that. So I guess the thing I always get people to try and remember is doing the slightly emotional manipulative thing, but here with me, wouldn't you rather take a bullet for your child than watch someone shoot your child? Like, if you had a choice, I would take that bullet, no problem, wouldn't think twice about it, than watch someone hurt my baby. So if you think about it like that, sometimes watching something unfold and happening to someone else, the response that you have in your body is remarkably similar, sometimes worse than if it was happening to you. And that is the amazing thing about the brain, right, is that it doesn't actually get the difference between real or imagined. And I really do think, particularly for birth workers, like the joke I used to have and I still have with my doula Angel is that she was the one who actually watched the episiotomy. She was the one watching me being held down. She was the one hearing all the language that was being used around me that I don't have a lot of memory of, as in non-trauma informed language. And so she was there watching it, absorbing the emotion. And I think sometimes when people are birth workers, your mind goes to the woulda, coulda, shoulda kind of stuff. Oh, I've seen this tree before. You know too much. This is the thing. And it takes quite a lot of practice and work to not go into that zone of your brain thinking that this is a time that has been in the past before. So I guess the classic example with that would be like, so with my second birth where I had severe shoulder dystocia, as soon as you say that phrase, I guarantee you so many midwives will immediately go back to a time when they've been on a drill, what do you do? They've been back to other cases that they've had shoulder dystocia. They've thought about the horrible case studies they've read about, whatever it might be. There are certain things that just take you back to a certain place in time. And unless you kind of do the work in the moment to go, oh, different day, different baby, different outcome, your body and your brain will just react as if you're back there again. So I think the thing with it being vicarious is that, it totally doesn't have to be happening to you. You can be witnessing it, watching it. There are some things I think that are worse potentially, to watch and listen to rather than experience them yourself, if that kind of makes sense.
Oh, that absolutely makes sense. Yes, for sure. Then the other thing, and you can correct me if I'm wrong of what I understand, which I think also helps add some validation, because I think it's so easy for us to not validate our experience or our feelings. We're trained to just to buck up and be strong, and we can power through, and we are so capable of powering through so much, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's sustainable long term. And your heart towards, you know, wanting to create an environment that is sustainable so that our daughters and their daughters have options for having these compassionate and caring individuals who are powerhouses and who absolutely do change the course of birthing mother's experience is, from my understanding, is the limbic system, that fight or flight part of our brain, the limbic system, doesn't have time connected to it. And I've heard that one large traumatic experience can be just as traumatic as multiple small traumatic experiences experienced over and over and over again. They kind of pile up. And because the brain doesn't have that ability to see all the time that necessarily was spread out between those experiences, it doesn't categorize it in that way. It just kind of piles on and piles on and piles on until now you're kind of experiencing this threshold that sometimes doesn't feel like it equals the trauma. Like if you look at the one small experience, you see this, my emotional response shouldn't be this big. But if you zoom out and then you see, oh, okay, it's compounded. Now I see that there's some more validation to this response that I have. And so someone who is in this field, who it, I think sometimes we also look at the outcome. Like you walked away with a healthy baby. Therefore, can we really categorize your experience as traumatic birth? You know, like we kind of almost minimize it, rather than saying your midwife or your doula did experience trauma because she watched that whole process. And even though thankfully you both walked away okay, you know, what about all those little things that added up to it? So my question, I guess, would say, I'm leading into a question, would be this idea that you talk about of compassion fatigue. Can we talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, I love talking about this because I think like compassion is often the antidote to trauma, more so than lots of other things. And there's some really cool research that's just starting to come out showing that compassion for self, compassion practices, anything to do with compassion is really going to help. But yet the number one thing often I would see, other than the minimization and all the things that you talked about, which is so true, is that the people who are there doing the work just don't have a lot of compassion for themselves. You know, there's this intolerance of, it's almost like, well, how dare I feel anything? How dare I, as you said, although I should be stronger, I should be this, I should be that. And so when that sort of starts building up over time, and you get into the like, I'm just so exhausted, all I can do is just curl into bed and I don't have time for this and I don't have time for that and I'm too exhausted. I think a thing, because I catch this in myself, so this is why I'm saying it, because it sometimes rings so true that if you actually examine that, sometimes it's, oh, I don't really think I deserve that. I don't really think I'm worth that. It's another form of invalidation, self-punishment, whatever you want to call it, that eventually leads to resentment for yourself, resentment for your industry. And when it gets really bad, when compassion fatigue is at its actual worst, I would say is it's when you're showing up to work and you actually just don't even give a crap about the clients or the patients or the people that you're supporting. And that is really, really dangerous. And that's the thing that I worry about the most, is that people sort of can very easily slip into this thing of, oh, well, I just have to keep going. The system's not going to change. I just have to be stronger. I have to be more resilient, because that's a thing that gets tossed around a lot, the good You know, we are almost throwing those phrases, be more resilient and do more self-care, to people kind of like a slur. Like, instead of actually giving them space and support and acceptance and normalizing and putting up a hand and going, oh, actually, we didn't train you in this. And not only did we train you, I'm your manager, supervisor, head of a hospital, head of a department, whatever. And I actually don't really know how to do this either. Well, the ego stuff, that what it all kind of boils down to is this system where people just keep showing up for work and they're not really able to be there physically, emotionally, spiritually, otherwise. It's just kind of going through the motions and being a robot, in which case I always think, well, why did people get into healthcare? Like, why go into helping and healing only to sort of blow out so much of that compassion and humanity? Like, yeah, it's potentially frightening. So, yes, compassion fatigue starts with little things, but it can very, 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 very easily blow out into this full-on, I'm really just going through the autopilot things and I'm actually going to just shut myself off from feeling anything. And that's not what birthing people need. That's not what birthing people and their babies and their families need. We need people who are human and who feel things, even if the things that they feel are not, you know, the, oh, just put your professional face on. Because I think we're taught that you should just have this blank, emotionless face, particularly like in a crisis. And I don't actually think that that really helps anybody. In fact, we know that it doesn't help. So it's finding that balance, I guess, between, yeah, everybody's terrified of inviting too much of their own emotion and then too much of their own reaction in, but sometimes that's actually what helps people, because it helps your brain when it's flooded with emotions and stress and fear to sort of validate what you're feeling in the moment. So I'm happy to talk more about that if you want me to keep talking about that.
Yeah, no, that's really good. So that balance of, because so often we are taught that the best response in a traumatic moment is to be stoic, is to look strong, to look confident, to not show any of your own emotion, because this isn't about you, this is about this other person. And so to have helpful tools of how to process in that moment and also at the, you know, after it's over, is very powerful. So yeah, if you've got some more to talk about, this is really fabulous.
It's early days with research again, but I think something I've stumbled across, which was actually very validating for me, because it's always nice when you find some research that kind of cements what you feel already. So if we go back to that second birth of mine, something that I actually found really, really helpful was the fact that my doula was the only one who had any sort of genuine look of concern on her face. Everybody else around me, as things were unfolding, did the keep calm and carry on face. And I think there's something, you know, if you've ever birthed, you know that you're so open, right? You're so vulnerable. And I really think in that state, birthing people are very, very, very susceptible, very perceptive, very good readers of people and their emotions. So I think if there's ever a time where your poker face isn't going to work, I think it doesn't work very well on birthing people, particularly if they're stressed. So strangely enough, her actually looking into my eyes, holding my hand and sort of just giving me a face of, I don't remember what she said, but it was the glimmer of, yeah, I think something's not quite okay either. Because my husband's face was like pretty blank, keep calm, carry on. Everybody else was sort of just going about their business. And so this piece of research I stumbled across actually doesn't come from birth research. It's from social anxiety research, where there's some, I can't remember who the researchers were, but there's some information showing that for people with severe social anxiety, when they come across a neutral or a calm face, they can actually interpret that as being threatening. So that's interesting if you think about connecting that with being in a situation where, again, you're so open, you're so vulnerable, you're so suggestible. If you suspect that something's not quite right and then people are not, I suppose, validating that experience, sometimes that could possibly be even more scary because you think, ooh, right, people aren't letting on that something's, you know, not okay. And yet I don't feel okay, and it's confusing. And I remember that feeling, I suppose, very, very well, of thinking like, I'm sure something's not quite right, but nobody's giving me any indication. It's not actually really helping to keep me calm. And I think that's often the thing that people worry about, at least when midwives and doulas and OBs and, you know, all the other amazing birth workers who are out there talk about. They're like, oh, but I don't want to intrude. I don't want to make things worse. I'm like, it goes back to that humanity thing again, right? But sometimes it's just someone holding your hand. Sometimes it's just someone saying, look, I don't really know what's going on at the moment, but I'm here with you and we're in this together. Like, that kind of response can be so, so, so powerful beyond the how quickly sometimes, particularly in an emergency, right, where a room just fills with people and there's one person, you know, lying on a table or whatever's happening to them, and they're like, okay, so something is serious now because my room is full of people and it wasn't before. Nobody's explaining that. I don't really understand what's happening and how quick we are to provide support, I suppose, when there's a physical emergency, a physical trauma, something physical happening. Like, the word trauma in medicine and forensics still means a physical injury, so we've still got a long way to go. But there's no psychological support. And it doesn't mean I don't necessarily think that we need like psychologists in every single birthing room, although that would be interesting. And the people I've talked to who are psychologists, doulas, I'm like, that's something interesting in that. But just having one person in any emergency, I don't care like how short a time is, you've got time. Somebody has got to have time to be the person to just hold somebody's hand, reassure them that things are going to be okay. Or if they're not okay, you don't have to lie and say they're going to be okay. Just say, I'm here. I'm here for you. I see you. I'm with you. That can make such a difference. And that's a bit that we often forget about.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I remember with one of my births, my son wound up coming out with a cord wrapped around his neck. And during the pushing phases, you know, they were taking his heartbeat. And then I saw the midwives like make eye contact and like non-verbally communicate that there was a problem. And I sensed it immediately. And so I started like asking questions and it felt like they wanted to protect me and their intention was so good, but it almost caused me more anxiety because I could tell they weren't telling me the whole story and I was hyper aware of what was going on. And I just remember saying like, is everything okay? What's going on? And they were like, well, we need to get them out quick. But it wasn't the full story. And I remember that rise in anxiety in my own, like inside of like, wait, I don't know what's going on. Like, what's going on? So that almost caused more panic instead of just like direct, like communication of like, okay, the heartbeat's dropping a little bit. This is what we're dealing with. Everything will be fine if we get them out quickly. It was more, they felt like to protect me. So that was interesting too. Where I totally could see from their perspective and it wasn't something that I thought they did wrong. But from my perspective, I was just like, wow, a little more information would have been helpful for my own anxiety in that moment.
I think it's huge. And I don't doubt that so many people are operating from a point of, well, I don't know if I can, what I can say and what I can do, because I also don't want to get sued, I don't want to get into trouble, all that sort of stuff. But it is very much, I think, an ingrained thing. I still remember with my first birth, I've talked about when I was hemorrhaging and I lost quite a lot of blood, but I was a first-time mum and I didn't really know like what's a normal amount of blood loss. But I had a midwife who kept putting her eyebrows up to another midwife, and I was in like 10 out of 10 pain at this point, and someone had offered me some gas and air, so I took a little bit, and that you just go a bit loopy, and so I felt a little bit more a bit less lucid, I suppose. And I remember saying to her, like, put your eyebrows down. She was like, what? I said, I like, and then I went into my like, hey, I'm a clinical psychologist, you're putting your eyebrows up, that means something of note. What's happening? What's going on? And she's like, oh no, I'm just, you know, concentrating on putting this, whatever she was doing. And I knew it was a lie. And I'm like, again, I don't know if you're trying to protect me, if it's because you don't want to say you don't know what's happening. I'm like, put your eyebrows down. And that's just like, it's that one tiny little thing. But again, I swear, so suggestible. And then you give someone some gas and air and then they're like, you know, even more inhibitions are down. It's the funny things that you remember in birth and also when your emotions are heightened. So I really do think, yeah, facial expressions and what you're doing with your body, you might think you're doing an amazing job not saying anything. I'm like, people know. And I don't necessarily think it is, even though it's well intended, it's maybe not that helpful in the time to sort of just blatantly pretend that things are fine if they're not. Yeah.
Absolutely. I love that. Put your eyebrows down.
Yeah. Put them down.
So let's move into some more practical. So we're seeing that being a birth worker is a job. It's a calling where we are exposed to other people's trauma, which then impacts us. So when we're talking about one, supporting ourselves, how do we get past the initial resistance to needing support ourselves? So I think that's the first start. Like, it's not necessarily, I think sometimes we jump into these, what should I do to support myself? But I think taking it back a step further of, if I have internal resistance to feeling like I need support in this role, like my head knows, like, okay, this logically makes sense, that I should have some form of support for myself because of the experience I am putting myself in over and over and over again. But internally, there's this little bit of resistance, not exactly sure how to label it. How would you initially start processing that resistance?
Oh, I love this question because this is like such a tricky thing and it's such a common thing and I'm guilty of it too. So I don't ever suggest things to people that I'm not willing to do myself. So I'll tell you a mini story about something that helped me, that someone said to me. I'm like, oh, that's a powerful visual. So in that moment, I think you can apply this also to motherhood, because like the martyrdom stuff that's been handed down for generations is also a huge area where all of this stuff creeps in, like, oh, I shouldn't need to do this. I shouldn't need to do that. My mother didn't do it. Her mother didn't, whatever. But you imagine there's a knock at the door and you're opening the door and you're actually looking at yourself in the, whether it is the sitting and crying on the kitchen floor, sobbing into your ice cream with snot hanging out your nose moment, like whatever the moment is, that's been your like, oh, this is pretty low, this is pretty bad, and yet you've told yourself to push through, I don't need any support, I don't need any help, I should be able to do this. You picture that. She's at the door. Now, are you going to slam the door in her face and say, come on, get up, get on with it, stop being such a baby, whatever it is you're telling yourself that's the punishing stuff in the moment, or would you let her in? You know, make her a cup of tea, give her a hug, look after her, be compassionate, show her compassion. So, you know, it's that thing of sometimes that's harder for people to do and we need to start like smaller and do the, well, what if this was your best friend? What if this was your son, your daughter? What if this was someone that you care a lot about? For some people it might even be, well, what if this was your dog at the door? Someone that you have a lot of compassion and love and care for. If you agree that you wouldn't like slam the door in their face and just say, come on, get on with it, you've got to keep going, and have no compassion, then applying that for yourself. That's sometimes the first step. I think it's not the, you don't want this to be yet another thing to add to your list of tasks that you should be doing at the end of the day, because we've got enough of that and the list is never going to be complete and it's always going to be like, well, did I drink enough water? Was I mindful enough? Did I not shout enough? Did I do this enough? Like, it's never going to be enough. It's just like the mandala. Every day I think you build it and then blow it away, and that's just life. But I think being able to start with that, ooh, okay, so is it that I you know, when there's resistance, what's it really about, I suppose? Is it that, because my stuff sometimes is that I'm too tired for that. I'm too tired to do self-care. I just want to crash into bed and be so exhausted every night, which sometimes is true, and that's okay. But it becomes like those neural pathways, particularly for me, like they're so strong. They're so strong. I will not even catch myself saying that before I've thrown myself into bed without going, oh, hang on. But do I maybe have time to just do like three quick things? Like I could take some vitamins. I could say a couple of affirmations and mean it. I could take some deep breaths, you know, whatever it might be. And it's often going to be really, really, really tiny microscopic things that you can do even if you're so exhausted you can't even keep your eyes open. That's sort of where I try and operate from. I, you know, I think starting with that, all right, yeah, can you show yourself some compassion? And if you are standing at your front door looking at this person, what do they need? What do they need? And are you going to act with compassion and look after them, or are you going to, yeah, slam the door in their face and say, get lost?
Absolutely. I think that it's really important what you just said as far as the mindset we enter into this, even beginning to have this conversation around having self-care, that it can't be this one more thing that you're adding to your list to be a whatever, a good person or a good midwife or a good birth worker or somehow enough. Because like you said, the list is always there. It's always growing. It's never going to be completed. We will never be able to all day, every day, check everything off the list and give ourselves pats on the back. That's just not life. And so if we approach self-care as one more to do, then it can become almost a burden, a heavy weight, a thing that we're almost disappointing ourselves in again and again. But if we can approach it in that way of, I'm going to just look at this person with compassion, like you said, meet myself where I'm at, even if I'm not necessarily motivated by myself, maybe I'm motivated by my best friend, the idea of my best friend or my dog or whoever I deeply, deeply love, that how would I nurture and care for that person? Like, what would compassion look like in that situation? And I think approaching it in that way makes it a lot less weighty, a lot less like a burden, and a lot more like, okay, I could do this. And like you're saying, it can be real small and it matters. Like, I think another thing with our culture in today's mindset is only big things matter. Only things I pay a lot of money for and put a ton of effort into, the blood, sweat, and tears, that's what's going to change my life. But these small things I'm doing as I'm, you know, falling into bed, you know, could they really make an impact? It feels like we can really easily dismiss the small daily rituals because it almost feels like they're too easy.
Yeah.
To make an impact.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So what are your favorite ways or some tools that you have in your back pocket that you love to give to your clients or help them explore to combat this burnout feeling or the emotional exhaustion? What first steps do you recommend?
I think you've got to look at something that's a non-negotiable anyway to start with, because 9 times out of 10, you'll end up hearing that, well, I don't have time for that. Yep, 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 I get it. So find something that you are already doing anyway that's a non-negotiable. Peeing is usually one of those. So I would say most people cannot argue with the fact that you are going to get through the day. Some point, you're going to have to go to the bathroom. So every time you go to the toilet, that's going to be the time that you do your 20 seconds of self-care, which might mean some really good, deep diaphragmatic breathing. It might mean when you're at work, actually doing not, you know, like 30 minutes of mindfulness on the beach kind of stuff, that would be great, but a great mindfulness, bring yourself back to the present tool for staying in the moment and preventing trauma is actually just doing that really simple phrase, different day, different birth, different baby, different outcome, and actually get yourself into the habit of telling your brain where you are, what you're doing, because it will slip. It will so easily slip back into Oh, the amazing, like, memory triggers for things that you can't even verbalize. Like, it could be the smell of someone's perfume. It could be the sound of someone's voice, the way they tilt their head, anything. And you don't realize it at the time, but that's reminding you of a birth from the past that didn't go so wonderfully. It could be, you know, you're struggling to connect with someone because they remind you of someone who was horrible to you in high school. Like, all the kind of subtleties that we don't realize that we're responding to throughout the day. So I think doing those really quick check-ins that might just be every time you go to the bathroom, putting your hand on your diaphragm and taking three breaths and, like, really proper good core breaths. Bathrooms are not always the best place to do that, particularly in a hospital, but you get the idea. Or when you walk through a doorway, and it might be, yeah, I think using some phrases, just affirmations only work if you actually believe them and you're actually willing to, like, fully embrace them. There's no point doing, like, I suppose what you could call pseudo coping. Like, anyone can write up a list of affirmations and put them around their house and go, yep, cool. And then they get disappointed and don't work. So that it has to be something that you actually feel, want, believe in the moment. You can't make them, you can't force them, and you can't try and make them fit if you're not going to believe them. But I think that staying in the present moment, just by doing that, telling yourself what month it is, what year it is, where you are, those kinds of things. And it has to be at the start, at least, pairing it with something that you absolutely 100% have to do and not making yourself feel too bad. Because sometimes people do, they're like, we'll do it when you take your makeup off or when you brush your teeth. And then you think about those guilty, you don't want it to be paired with guilt and shame for times that, like, well, sometimes maybe you don't take your makeup off. Oh, bad. Sometimes you don't brush your teeth. Oh, bad, shame. So we don't want to pair it with something that's maybe, you know, you should, but you actually don't. But going to the bathroom is generally like, well, most people at some point during the day have to pee. So that's kind of mine. It could be opening your fridge, walking through a doorway, find something that is an absolute non-negotiable, you're going to do this every day, and start there. Start really, really, really small, pairing of something that you're already doing, because then it gets into a new habit. It's easier to put an old habit together with a new habit than starting something brand new. And you'll find that might seem super simple, but people will still struggle with it. They'll still say, oh, I didn't have time to do that. I'm like, okay. Don't have time or don't value it, because that's another big one of mine is we all say it. Like, I'm not perfect by any means, but I think trying to get into the practice of saying, I don't value that in this moment. And if you don't value it in the moment, that's okay, but make sure that that's what you're saying to yourself instead of I don't have time, because I'm really good at that. I don't have time for that. I don't have time for self-care. Oh, caught myself. I don't value that in the moment. Do I really not value it, or is that an old story? What's something real quick I could do? Might just be a glass of water, going and washing your hands. Like, really small things to bring yourself back into your body is a big thing that I'm a fan of too. So it doesn't have to be go and add something brand new to your list to do. Just, yeah, pair it with something that you're already doing that's meeting one of those really basic needs.
Absolutely. That's so practical and powerful, because we can so easily, I think, start with a really complicated plan of, like, I'm going to get up 30 minutes earlier and I'm going to journal and I'm going to then exercise and then I'm going to do, like, whatever, you know, 30 minutes of self-care, and then it just doesn't happen because of life and exhaustion and all the things. And so then we just doesn't happen. And so for us to start with something, we got to pick one thing we're going to do every day, no matter what. And, you know, I think even just practicing that, you know, brutal honesty with ourselves of saying, rather than I don't have time, okay, maybe I don't value this. Maybe I'm just right now, I'm struggling with a lot of resistance towards self-care. And maybe even starting with a mantra that is really learning to, you know, go at those neural networks, go at that, rather than feeling like I'm just, this is the way I am. Maybe I can rewire my nervous system and my neural networks to, every time I take a drink of water, to say, I value taking care of myself. And even though it might not feel like it, or I might not, you know, feel like waking up 30 minutes extra every day or whatever I have decided I think it should look like, that when I do pause and take care of myself in the simple, small things, even going to the bathroom, when you're in the middle of a shift and like you're in the middle of, you know, this mom is in the middle of this and this and this, and all of a sudden you're holding your urine for however long, that pause to go to the, actually go to the bathroom and take care of yourself is actually self-care. And even though, you know, your body's basically forcing the issue, you're still choosing to listen to your body and choosing to honor that. So I think that's really powerful, just starting with those kinds of things and acknowledging, even though I might not even feel like I care about self-care, I do in some ways. And so I'm going to honor the ways that I, you know, my starting point, and then it grows from there.
Yeah, and it has to, because, you know, our birth work is, the standards for what self-care is are pretty low. Like you're talking about, you know, the amount of midwives and teachers and, again, people in helping healer professions who have UTIs, and then that can be the kind of self-sabotaging thing. Like I can only take time off and look after myself if I'm so physically ill that I can't go to work. That's a thing that people do to themselves quite a lot. I hear the stories about the midwives who wear maternity pads all the time and they're not pregnant and haven't just had a baby. It's because they don't have time to pee. Like these are all the things that are going on that people don't talk about because, again, it's the martyr stuff. Well, I've got this many people to care for. I've got this much time. And it's like, yep. But, you know, we have to move on from this image that I sometimes have in my mind of, yeah, the midwife who is so under the pump that she's peeing into maternity pads and she's living off like two crackers in the sniff of like the hope of the will to live. That's no way forward. And the way forward isn't to then like jump all over that with a whole bunch of Instagram posts that make you feel bad for not being able to do more and make it more pretty and whatever else. Like all that stuff is great. But I think we've got to really look at the guilt and the shame and the martyrdom stuff first, and then not like have self-care and building resilience as a blaming reaction to that. Like it's, as you say, it's acknowledging it. It's meeting yourself where you are and not, I suppose, kidding yourself that you're further along than you are by saying, yep, I'm going to get up 30 minutes earlier. Like personally, I hate all that stuff. I really... I'm not a fan of the, particularly when it's directed towards women, I suppose, though, like, if you want your business to be successful, you're going to have to get up half an hour early. Like, no, I'm sorry, but F that. My children slept 2 hours last night. I'm not getting up 30 minutes earlier to bliss out and do yoga or work on my business or whatever, like sleep. You've got to look at that, like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the sleep, the eating. Like the really, really, really basic human 101. And we're starting really, really small for some people because I know that that's where they are. So it has to be absolutely so achievable that you would look at that and go, I can't believe that stupid psychologist wasted an hour of my time on a podcast recommending something so silly. And yet, okay. See the challenge. If you excel at that and that is like so easy to do, you can do it with your eyes closed, congratulations, you are well on your way. But for a lot of people, it's going to be like, oh, right, yeah, okay, that's, yeah, I'm really going to have to look at this and look at if it's not that I don't have time and it's not that, oh, okay, I don't value this. Why don't I value this? Or look at all the, you know, the family lineage stuff of, oh, women don't need to do that. And I say that because it often is the women and the mums, the martyrdom stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got it from both directions. You've got it from personal life saying, oh, mums shouldn't need to do whatever, would insert your chosen idea of self-care here. And then you go to work and you've got it at work. Oh, you shouldn't need to do that. Or you shouldn't need to charge money. You should just enjoy looking after people, even if you're like completely and utterly spread thin and have got nothing left to give. Because this is it, the whole thing about like filling your own cup. Like, yep, it would be great if the cup is running over. I want the cup to be so running over that like people are just, you know, happy to be in your splash zone. But a lot of these birth worker cups haven't even got like a millimeter of water in them. They're dry.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to work on, you know, basic I don't know where I'm going with this metaphor, hydration.
Yeah.
Put some water in the buckets.
Exactly. It's so good. So wrapping things up here, what are 1 to 3 just practical tips that you would want to share for birth workers connected to that idea of filling their cup? Mm. What do you see as making the biggest impact in their cups being filled?
I think, like, we're pretty good at the neck up stuff in terms of the things that you say to yourself. So whether that's the coping statements, the affirmations, the staying in the mindful moment mantra kind of stuff, which is the, you know, different baby, different outcome, different whatever. But it's the neck down stuff, I think, that people are not acknowledging as much. The fact that you can, you know, have a stressful work experience, whether that's you dealing with birth trauma or whether it's occupational stress, bullying, just the general ins and outs of interpersonal stress at work. I think talking about it is one thing, but often it's not enough for things to get shifted. So I think learning some really easy functional bodily strategies, and that might be learning how to breathe properly. Like, really?
Mm-hmm.
Really learning how to breathe properly, because most of us are not taught how to take a decent deep breath. We're taught, like, well, as you would know, to like suck in your stomach, and like it's all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most helpful things you could do is actually, like, I suppose, entertain the idea that maybe what you think is a good deep breath actually isn't a good deep breath, and just see it as like a lack of skills training, like anything else, you know, like if you'd been taught to do something one way, make a coffee, and there's other ways to make coffee, like, or drive or whatever it might be, you just go and find someone who can teach you that skill. And there's plenty of people. There's YouTube. You could, you know, do some Googling. That wouldn't hurt. So I think taking proper breaths and actually learning what a proper breath is and learning to catch yourself when you're falling into shallow, not helpful, likely to induce panic, anxiety type breathing. That's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds simple, and it's really not. It's really, really not. And that's so connected with birth and everything else that I could get into, but I won't. So learning to take decent breaths, but also like small things, like learning some acupressure. Like if you're a birth worker, you should be knowing acupressure anyway, because it's amazing. It's the kind of, whether that's acupressure or something like EFT, tapping, so that's the emotional freedom technique, combining both together. I think research is getting a lot better at acknowledging that things that have been around way longer than Western medicine have actually got some use, and we can measure it. So I would suggest to people learning something like EFT, which you can just do on YouTube by yourself. It's amazing. And you can also learn acupressure by yourself. Taking courses, reading books, that's all amazing. But if all you did was learn one like little move that you could just do with your hands, even if you're, you know, attending a birth and you're busy, yeah, you didn't have time to go and do a full yoga stretch and do all that. I get that. But there are definitely some pressure points on your body, on your hands, neck, shoulders, wherever you want to choose, that are helpful. And they're also really helpful for people in birth. So that to me just seems like a no-brainer for skills that we should be learning. And I think the other one is acceptance, like learning to sit with this is how I feel and it's okay, instead of trying to shove it away, get rid of it, distract yourself, because it's another thing that we're taught, right? So I guess it goes back to that, what's it called, ironic process theory. So I pretty much tell this to everyone, the don't think about a pink elephant. You know, whatever you think about, don't think about a pink elephant. You're going to start thinking about the pink elephant. So it would be nice if phrases like, don't worry, just think about something else, actually worked. But you kind of have to think, if that worked, I and other people who work in mental health wouldn't actually been able to have a job, because if it was just as simple as don't worry and don't think about it and that worked, yeah, I wouldn't have spent 12 years of my life at university just to like learn, oh, you just say don't worry and don't think about it. It doesn't work. So retraining, again, talking about neural pathways before, retraining that instant desire to just think about something else because that's what we're taught as kids. I'll stop crying. Oh, look, something's shiny over there. Oh, look, we're so quick to get rid of negative feelings because they're unpleasant. But the thing that tends to help negative feelings is accepting them and building tolerance for them. And that might be that you can only do 10 seconds of sitting there and going, I feel uncomfortable, I feel awful, right, 10 seconds are up, let me move on. But that's actually what helps. And that's one of the biggest strategies for trauma in general is working with thoughts, images, memories, smells, sounds, whatever that are really, really challenging, that they're the things that pop in your head that you're like, oh my God, I just don't want to be thinking about this. This is horrible. Imagine if people knew I was thinking this. So I'm sitting with them and acknowledging them and going, okay, that's a thought. That's a feeling. It's okay. Mm-hmm. I don't have to do anything with it. It's really challenging. It is really, really, really challenging to have a thought and have a feeling and actually not do anything with it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Super challenging.
Thank you. Those are all really practical and really helpful. So to wrap things up, can you tell our listeners if they want to connect with you more, where the best place to connect with you is?
So probably my website, which is drerin.com.au, as I'm in Australia, or Instagram. I hang out there, which is at Dr. Erin Bauer. That's my two. That's what I can manage, right? There's so many different platforms. There's YouTube as well. I have a podcast as well, which is Birth Trauma Training for Birth Workers, funnily enough.
Yes. And I highly recommend that podcast.
Well, thank you. Yeah. It's my excuse.
Well, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your wisdom. And I just am so appreciative of you sharing with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been fun.
That was good, right? While we can't include every perspective or break down every piece connected to trauma and birth, I love that we're even starting to have these types of conversations and wrestling out these perspectives and even asking ourselves, what do we think and what do we believe? So remember when Dr. Erin said that most of us don't even know how to take a deep breath? I made a video tutorial for you guys walking you through the basics of breath and how to start training your intercostal muscles so that you can expand your rib cage to the fullest and not have to rely on your belly only. If that sounds interesting to you, go ahead and head to the show notes from today's episode at thrivingbirthworker.com, episode 4. You'll find the link there. Thank you so much for joining me this week. If you haven't yet, go ahead and hit subscribe to stay in the loop on the next episodes. What would also be amazing is if you enjoy these conversations and would like to hear more, a rating and review means the very most to us podcast creators. It helps us connect with other amazing birth workers like you and spread our message. So to leave a review on iTunes, you click on the show icon, scroll past the episode to the bottom, and you can select to write a review and to rate. I'm always grateful to connect with you in this special way, and I hope you have an amazing week. The information and discussion provided on this podcast are not intended and should not be construed as medical advice. If you have a medical concern, you should consult with an appropriately licensed physician or healthcare provider.